Marty Moss Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Have you noticed the plethora of polls lately? It seems the closer we get to Election Day, the more polls there are and the more poll results seem to drive the news. There's Gallup, Daily Kos, Pew, Rasmussen, NBC, Wall Street Journal, Ipsos, Reuters, Quinnipiac, CBS, New York Times, Fox, Maris McClatchy. I could go on. Some say the presidential race is essentially a dead heat, while others give President Obama an edge. But with less than 6 weeks, four debates, and millions of dollars worth of political ads to go, what do we need to know about polls and polling, our topic for today's Radio Times? Let me introduce our two guests. Joining us from the studios of Emory University is Alan Abramowitz. He's the Alvin W. Barkley Professor of Political Science at Emory, and nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be with you.
Also with us is Mark Blumenthal, senior polling editor of the Huffington Post and the founding editor of Pollster.com. And Mark Blumenthal, nice to have you with us as well.
Nice to be on.
Alan, if I can begin with you, is it my imagination or are there just more polls and more polling organizations today than there were 4 years ago?
Well, actually, for a long time, there were fewer polls coming out this year than 4 years ago. But in the last couple of weeks, I think we've seen a considerable acceleration in the pace of polling. There are some new polling organizations around this year that we didn't have 4 years ago, and there are a lot of the same organizations. So I would say overall the pace of polling right now is probably comparable to what we had 4 years ago, but there are a lot of polls.
Does that mean we're just getting closer to Election Day and closer to when people begin to really pay attention to the presidential race, for instance?
Well, yes, as we get closer to Election Day, you definitely start to see more polls, more national polls, and also a lot more polls in some of the key battleground states. People have actually been following the presidential race pretty closely for a long time. It's not like they've just suddenly started to tune in, but I think in terms of polling, that a lot of these polling organizations don't start to poll regularly until after the conventions are over.
Mark, you want to add to that?
I think that's about right. If anything, the pace was slower this year, I think mostly because we had a sort of an epic primary battle in 2008 that went all the way to the last primary, and I think that made for a lot more statewide polling earlier on. What we've had over the last four or five election cycles is an explosion of a new kind of survey done rather inexpensively using an automated method, a recorded voice, and that asks the selected respondents to answer by pressing buttons on their phone. And that's meant for a whole lot more data. We've also seen this year, I think, the most in the way of a whole new kind of survey done online that doesn't involve the traditional random sample at the beginning. So it's an interesting new world.
Mark, who's doing that that automated polling?
What we're seeing is mostly so far at the national level, but the Ipsos organization partnered with Reuters. Ipsos is a big multinational research company and also a company called YouGov that sponsors surveys with The Economist magazine. And what they do is a little different. Traditionally, surveys have started with a random sample, usually a phone number. Sometimes, if you go all the way back to Gallup in the 40s and 50s, it would be done in person at home. What they've done, there's no way to sort of replicate that online because there's no sort of random way of emailing or contacting everyone else online. And, of course, not every American's online.
Right.
The penetration of the Internet's only about, I think, 70%. So what they've done is recruited people by the hundreds of thousands, sometimes millions, who agree to do surveys routinely, and then they try to adjust what they get statistically to make it representative. It's a little bit controversial.
Indeed. Let me go back to Alan Abramowitz. And from your perspective, what are some of the best practices when it comes to polling that reliable, legitimate pollsters should do?
Well, I don't know that there's one way that's necessarily the only, you know, legitimate way of doing polling, but to my mind, I think at this point in time, the best polls are using live telephone interviews that include calls to cell phones. And the reason that's important now is because an increasing percentage of households in the United States are cell phone-only households. Mm-hmm. And those cell phone-only households are distinctive. They're different from households that have a landline phone. They're disproportionately lower-income folks, members of minorities, younger people. And so if you're not calling cell phones, and the automated pollsters don't generally call cell phones, you're missing those groups, and then you have to correct for that by weighting your sample to try to create a representative sample, and that can lead to some problems. And we're seeing some differences in the results of the automated polls and the polls that are using live telephone interviews with calls to cell phones this year. Some systematic differences with the live interviewer polls generally showing better results for Obama and Democrats than the automated polls.
What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that they're reaching a broader, more representative cross-section of the voting age population, or of the likely voters. That includes these younger voters, minorities, and so on. And that the weighting procedures used by the automated pollsters to correct for their imbalance are not quite successfully compensating for the fact that they're not reaching cell phones.
Mark, picking up on that and even just throwing my own personal response to when my phone rings in my house, is there a problem for pollsters in that people don't answer their phone perhaps the way they did 10 or 15 or maybe even a generation ago?
That's absolutely a problem. It's a problem that they don't answer the phone at all, no matter who's calling. They're less willing to cooperate with survey calls when they come. And as Alan said, a very large percentage now are not accessible at all by landlines. 10 years ago, the number of Americans who had only a cell phone, no landline phone at all, was in the low single digits. It's estimated to be about a third of American households now. And Alan's right. The cell phone-only households are different. They're much, much younger. But even after pollsters weight by age and by race and by the other things they weight by, they've found that doing a survey with landline phones only tends to be a little bit more Republican than if you had called both. The trick here is that in either calling cell phones or in doing all this sort of advanced waiting that some of these other methodologies do, we've gotten away from the idea that at least some of us learned when we took statistics long ago that a random sample was sort of a was something where everyone in the population had an equal or a known chance of being selected. We really don't know. If we're calling, if you have both a landline phone and a cell phone, it's not clear which you answer most, whether you answer either. When a stranger comes, we don't really know, as we used to, the probability of getting any given person. We try to call, Alan's right, but I think the most expensive and the most reliable methods are doing dual-frame samples. Sorry for the jargon. They're calling
okay.
both cell phones and landlines, and they put them together. The process of putting them together and weighting them together is still, I wouldn't say experimental, but it's still kind of a work in progress, even at the most sophisticated levels.
So picking up on what you both have said, Alan Abramowitz, is it best then to think of a poll as a snapshot of a certain time and perhaps even a certain place?
Well, absolutely. There's no question that the results of any poll are limited to the particular time when the poll was done and the particular population that's being surveyed. Now, I think it's very interesting that the HuffPost pollster has done recently is they've come out with a new polling average in which they're able to use the results of state polls combined with national polls to come up with a more accurate estimate of where the national race is. So they're using the state poll results as well as the national poll results. And I believe they're also using the national poll results to factor it into their estimates of the state poll. So
yes, that's
an
right.
interesting development, and it's one that makes a lot of sense to me. So that's adding kind of a new wrinkle to this and using a very sophisticated sort of modeling process to do that. And I think the results are very interesting.
Picking up on what you said earlier, Alan Abramowitz, about the importance of having a live, I guess, telephone conversation when it comes to polling, why is that important? And I'm thinking about tone of voice. I'm thinking about wording of questions. All those perhaps obvious, maybe even subliminal things that could possibly influence someone in talking to a pollster.
Well, all those are important. And they're important whether it's an automated poll or a live interviewer poll. The folks who do the automated polls will actually argue that one advantage of their technique is that the voice is recorded, and therefore everyone is receiving exactly the same, you know, message with the same tone of voice. There's no variation at all. Whereas with live interviewers, of course, there is some variation.
Sure, sure. You wanted to add to that, Mark? Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to jump in and say I think that the caution that both Alan and I completely agree on this. The problem with the automated surveys, the problem that they're having this cycle, is that they're barred by federal law from calling automated phones or from calling mobile phones. Oh. You cannot use an auto dialer to call a mobile phone. So they either have to pay way more money to have human beings dial those lines, or they've tried some other techniques. But I think that's the primary problem. There are some others that are more technical in nature. But I think that the fairest thing you can say about it is that there are trade-offs. When you have a live human being doing an interview, they can clarify, they can keep the person interested, they can keep them on the phone. When you have a recorded voice, you have a different advantage, which is there isn't another person on the other end of the phone. So if you're embarrassed or feel uncomfortable sharing your vote preference with a stranger, if you're the kind of person who knows that you don't vote but you don't like to admit that because it's sort of socially inappropriate to say you're not voting, I think there is some evidence that taking the interviewer out of the equation can make for more accurate measurement. But there's a trade-off because we're losing some things on the sampling side.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan Abramowitz. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, and I believe it's also the case that the actual response rate to the automated phone calls is much lower than to the live interviewer calls. It's pretty low for live interviewer calls as well.
Right.
But with the automated calls, obviously it's easier for someone to just hang up. And a lot of people do that. The large majority of people actually don't respond. So there again, you're taking your chances on whether you actually end up with a representative sample, even of the phone numbers that you're able to reach.
Go ahead, Mark. Yeah, we're almost having a break, but go ahead.
The one part of this debate that sort of raged for the last 10 years is if you look at the final polls, the polls done in the last 2 weeks or so, and compare them to the result, over the course of the last 7 or 8 election cycles, the automated polls have been about as accurate as anything else, as the live interview surveys. I think there's a little bit of evidence that in 2010 we started to see that cell phone-only problem crop up in some of the more prominent robo-polls. And Alan is right that there have been some pronounced, what we call house effects, consistent differences from one pollster to another, where the automated firms, particularly the ones that aren't doing much of anything to adjust for or account for those missing cell phone-only households, are producing more Republican results.
Well, let's take a short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about polls and pollsters. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Fox Broadcasting Company, presenting the season premiere of New Girl and the new comedies Ben and Kate and The Mindy Project, airing tonight at 8 on Fox 29.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Are you drinking more than you want to? Would you like to reduce your drinking? UPenn is conducting a 13-week research study of a medication to help people reduce their drinking. To participate, you must be 18 to 65 and a regular drinker. The study provides a medical evaluation, including blood tests, brief counseling, and monitoring of your drinking. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 241. 215-222-3200, extension 241.
I'm Mike and Scott. Listener support is vital to WHYY, and we'll be asking for yours during our upcoming membership campaign. But the October buyback is your chance to help give us a head start. Make a pledge during our October buyback, and for every 750 donations we receive, you'll buy back one day. This means one less day of pledge and one more day of news without membership breaks. Do your part at whyy.org/support. Thank you.
Supporting WHYY, Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages, like their sweet and tart hibiscus cranberry juice. Locations and more at TraderJoe's.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are discussing and dissecting polls and pollsters, talking with Mark Blumenthal, senior polling editor of the Huffington Post, the founding editor of pollster.com. Also with us is Alan Abramowitz. He's the Alvin W. Barkley Professor of Political Science at Emory University. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Alan, let me go back to you. And both you and Mark have talked about robocalls and some of these varying ways that polling organizations work. But it seems that Rasmussen has gotten a lot of criticism for the way it does its polling. Can you expand on that?
Well, Rasmussen is, of course, one of the automated polling firms. They've been around since, I think, the 2000 election, and they do a lot of polls. And so, you know, their results, because they do so many polls, both national and state-level polls, and they do a national tracking poll where they're actually reporting results every day,
right.
They are out there, you know, all the time. And in 2010, their results were showed, you know, a pretty consistent Republican lean. I think they were rated as the most inaccurate and Republican-leaning poll of any major polling organization that was doing many polls by Nate Silver of the New York Times, mm-hmm. who has the 538 blog. So, you know, there seems to be a problem with their technique. And indeed, they're now claiming that they're supplementing their automated polls, their calls to landlines, with some sort of online sample that they're using to try to bring in some of the groups that are missed with the calls to landlines. But, you know, they're not very open about their methodology, and I think that's one of the problems with Rasmussen.
Mark, I did a little bit of reading about Rasmussen, which is that they work in a four-hour window. They apparently talk to the person who answers the phone. They don't do cell phones. They use a computer script. There's a low response rate, and they don't call people back. I'm quoting someone else who's done all this work. Maybe I'm even quoting you. But does that sort of describe what they do and why that raises questions about their results?
I mean, I think that the primary thing that they do, we've already talked about, which is the use of the inability of reaching those cell phone only households. Now, Alan's right; they do now. They claim to be contacting some small percentage of their samples using an online method that's pre-selected to be cell only, but they disclose virtually nothing more about it than what I just told you, and so it's sort of hard to evaluate. What I can say. In the way that we try to address this, which Alan mentioned at the HuffPost Pollster election dashboard, is we're trying to take all of the data out there and combine it in a way that's not skewed or tilted to whomever polls the most. So, you know, we can see from our model that Rasmussen does tend to be about a point more Republican on average on each candidate, so I guess that works out to about 2 points on the margin separating them. But that they're not the only ones with that kind of an effect. There are effects in both directions. And so we've tried to essentially average out the results in a way that puts each new poll into the appropriate context.
Alan, I'm assuming if a campaign is doing their own polling, they're probably doing internal polling for a candidate, but then they do some polling that they make public, and I'm assuming one must take that with a big grain of salt.
Sure, absolutely. And the difference between what they do internally and what they release is that they look at what they do internally, and when they have really good news, they like to share it.
Yeah, would you agree with that, Alan?
Oh, absolutely. I think you see that with both Democratic and Republican campaigns, and you know, I think it's wise to apply a discount, you know, to any polls that are put out in public by political campaigns. They're not giving you, you know, all of the information.
I've noticed sometimes traveling up and down the cable news, which I do from time to time. I think it's the Ed Show has a poll. And usually the results, Mark, are something like, you know, is President Obama a really good president? And the results are 95-5 or 97-3. Discount those polls entirely. I mean, did those even qualify as polls?
I'm not sure. I wasn't aware that the Ed Show did their own polling. I'm sure. Well,
I think they just grab at
the results that are most that fit whatever story they want to do that night.
I think they ask people to call in, Paul. Exactly.
Yeah, there's just it's
oh,
just
I
a,
see.
So,
yeah,
so it's
I
a
mean,
self-selected
you should,
sample.
Right. You should absolutely discount call-ins or you know, open internet sort of things where it's just the readers calling in or clicking through.
But we
are in a place where we're getting a lot of data that breaks all the rules. I mean, I think the question you asked about Rasmussen, calling only once, completing their interviews in a four-hour period rather than over a couple of days, taking whoever answers the phone rather than the random adult, which is something that all of the robo-pollsters do, all of those things break the rules that I was taught when I started as a pollster. And yet we've had this paradox for about 10 years that the results that they've produced are not particularly more or less accurate or more or less variable, given the number of interviews they're doing, than the surveys done using more expensive techniques, which is an awfully hard thing for someone who believes in following those rules and best practices to try to explain. And I think it probably does come down to the idea that I think attitudes in elections are not widely, if you look across subgroups, the differences aren't stark between older and younger voters. There are some places where they are, but a pollster like Rasmussen makes up for those differences by simply waiting on party identification, which is we could talk for an hour about.
Indeed.
But they take an educated guess at what the party leanings of a given state are, and they wait by it. And there are a lot of risky things about doing it, but given the way politics works, where 90% of Democrats vote for Democrats and 90% of Republicans typically vote for Republicans, if you guess right, the result's probably going to be pretty close.
Yeah, I think this year's election is going to be an interesting test,
right?
To see whether, because it does seem like we're seeing a growing disparity between the results being produced by the automated polls and the results being produced by the polls that are using live interviewers and that are calling cell phones. So, you know, at the end, we'll be able to see if that continues right up through Election Day, we'll be able to see who actually comes closer. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one other thing that I was going to bring up, which is that there, you know, another issue that arises nowadays with conducting polls is whether you're conducting polls, interviews in Spanish, because we have a growing percentage of the electorate who are primarily Spanish speakers. And, you know, there's some evidence from some polls that have been done of the Latino electorate in the United States that it makes a difference whether you do the interviews in Spanish or whether you do them in English. And there aren't very many polling organizations right now that are doing interviews in Spanish.
Interesting. I do want to get to our callers, but let me just throw out the question about undecided voters. Here we are near the end of September, and perhaps I can put this first to you, Alan Abramowitz. Who do you think these undecided voters are?
Well, there aren't very many of them, first of all. In some of the recent polls that I've been looking at, there are as few as 5% or even fewer who are undecided, don't even lean one way or the other. They tend to be, you know, people who are political independents.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be less interested. They're less attentive. They are not following the campaigns very closely. So they're hard for the campaigns to actually reach. And those are the people who don't make up their mind in many cases until the last few days of the campaign or even until Election Day. But again, we're talking about a very small percentage of the voters, especially this year.
Well, and Mark, it seems that those are the voters that the campaigns are focusing, you know, like a laser.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's one study that was written up in the New York Times column over the weekend that done online, but that enabled the researchers to look at a huge pool of people that they interviewed in December of 2011, and then they're recontacting them in random chunks every week. And what they found was a year ago, or I don't know, 8 or 9 months ago, there were only 5 or 6% who felt they were undecided in a choice between Romney and Obama. But in tracking the opinions of all the rest over the year, there are only another 5 or 6%, so maybe 1 in 10 voter total, that's been either completely undecided or that changed their vote, changed their preference over the course of the last year. So, yes, we're focusing an awful lot of attention where what we really care about are the movement of a small fraction of the electorate. That's what's unique about a presidential election as opposed to, say, races for Senate or Governor or Congress, where there's, I think, more volatility and more uncertainty.
And a very small percentage, a group of people that live in very specific counties in very specific states. Alan, you wanted to add to that, and then we'll get to our callers.
They're definitely focusing on the swing states because, you know, the states where the outcome is in doubt, because that's where the campaign can really make a difference. And they're only, at this point, you know, probably about 8 or 10 states, if that many, that where the outcome is really in doubt. But the other thing the campaigns are focusing on a great deal, because there are so few undecided voters and they're really hard to reach, is really just in trying to energize and turn out their own base. That's become the increasing focus of campaigns in recent elections. When you don't have very many undecided voters, it becomes more of a turnout game. And so I think the outcome of this year's election will hinge to a considerable extent on, you know, which party is more successful in getting their supporters to the polls.
Well, we are talking about polls and pollsters and talking with Alan Abramowitz. He's the Alvin W. Barkley Professor of Political Science at Emory University, joining us from their studios. Also with us, Mark Blumenthal, Senior Polling Editor of the Huffington Post and the founding editor of pollster.com. We have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get Julie from Center City, Philadelphia to join us. And Julie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's just my comment that I find them totally a nuisance. And what good do they do? I mean, people are going to do whatever they're going to do anyway, regardless if you've got 55 people asking you all these questions.
And Julie, do you find that pollsters are calling you a lot?
No, they're not, because I have a mobile phone, thank God, and nobody can get me.
Well, that's not true.
Well, go ahead, Alan.
Well,
why isn't that true?
Well, because there are polling organizations, as we were discussing earlier, that are calling mobile phones because of the fact that there are people like Julie who don't have a landline.
They can't get you,
but you may or may not choose to answer the poll.
But it is an interesting kind of cat and mouse game, Mark, that people are playing with pollsters.
Sure, and just to clarify, they're allowed to call if they use a live interviewer. The legal ban is on the automated method, which makes some sense. I mean, you don't want automated calls coming through while you're driving.
Indeed, the first question that is asked if you have a live interviewer calling a mobile phone is, are you driving? And if you are, please hang up and we'll call you back later.
I mean, I want to speak to the substance of what the caller said, which is, you know, what do we need to know for? Well, if you're trying to decide how to vote, I suppose you don't. I'm not sure it helps you that much to know the results of the horse race question that we've been focused on. Those of us who cover and follow politics are interested. I think we, our website, you know, I spend a fair amount of my day looking at who's ahead and who's behind, because there are, I don't know if it's a majority of Americans, but there are an awful lot of Americans who follow the news who care deeply about how their, if you will, team is doing. Follow politics like they do sports. They want to know, you know, Obama supporters want to know how their candidate's doing. Romney supporters want to know how their candidate's doing. But deeper than that, these surveys, when done well, and I think that's particularly true of some of the national news surveys that go beyond the horse race, they're trying to help us understand not just who's ahead or behind, but why. And what issues are moving voters and why is the election moving the way it has.
Go ahead, Alan.
And there are also academic surveys that are done for people like me that are a little bit different in that the focus there is not just on who's ahead and who's behind, but, again, on the whys and trying to understand what are the forces that are moving voters? How are they changing over time? How is the electorate changing over time? And what are the factors that influence voter decision-making over time? We even have panel surveys where we re-interview the same voters over time, and that allows us to look at how the campaigns are actually affecting voters. And I think these are important questions in terms of understanding our democracy and understanding what are the strengths and weaknesses of our democracy, like what is the influence of money?
Sure.
How is all this money that's being spent actually affecting the electorate?
Well, Alan, just picking up on that, and if there is a candidate that is pulling ahead, is there a certain kind of voter that basically wants to go with the winner and would be influenced by someone's lead in a poll?
You know, there's been some research on that to try to see if there is such a thing as a bandwagon effect. People want to be on the winning side, or on the other hand, an underdog effect. People might want to, feel some sympathy for the candidate who's behind. And my understanding is that there's not much evidence for either one of those effects, that generally people are not influenced very much at all by the results of polls in terms of deciding how they're going to vote, or even deciding whether they're going to vote. You might think if the poll shows one candidate far ahead, that might reduce the incentive for voting. And maybe there's a little bit of that, but certainly not very much. It just doesn't seem to make that much difference in terms of the individual voters' decision-making process.
Let me get Dan. Hold on once. Let me just get Dan from Winmore to join us. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I've been following the 538 blog, and I wonder if their methodology is sound and how much faith we can put in the probabilities they give. And in general, will pollsters use election results to refine their methodologies in the future? And finally, I would like to apologize to Alan because I was one of the unruly freshmen on the corridor of Hoeing 3 when he was at Rochester.
Oh my God.
As a senior on that corridor, going nuts from us.
Okay, fair enough. We'll let you and Alan.
That's a blast from the distance.
We'll let you work that out on email or something. Actually, let me take the 538 question and toss that to you, Mark, about a minute before our second break here.
I would urge all of your readers to stop reading 538 immediately and start following the election dashboard at pollster.com, which is a quick way of saying I'm probably a little biased on this.
Yeah.
We do a lot of what Nate does. I think there's a part of it that's it's a hard one to do in 60 seconds. I think the things that we do the same are trying to use all the polling and distill it down to an average that takes everything into account. Nate brings some things in beyond just the polling data, economic data, and so forth. And I think, getting the caller's point, it can be hard to tell what's polling and what's the assumption built in by the modeler. But
right,
I'm a rival, so
I agree with that.
I
agree with that. I mean, I think 538 is very interesting, and I follow both of them very closely, but. It's just not clear to me how Nate is bringing in this economic data and why he's using, these particular economic indicators and how he's combining them and weighting them. It seems to be somewhat arbitrary, as far as I can tell. Now, ultimately, the number he comes up with at the end, in terms of if you look at where he thinks the race is right now, and you look at pollster, you'll see that they're very similar. Very close.
Fair enough. Alan Abramowitz, Mark Blumenthal, we're talking about polls and pollsters, a full bank of calls. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Resident Ensemble Players, Delaware's professional acting company and residence at the University of Delaware, supports WHYY. The Rep offers the work and words of master storytellers and presents Connor McPherson's The Weir, September 27th through October 14th. A few mates gather at a pub in Ireland for pints and a spooky story or two. When a pretty stranger joins them, her tale becomes the most eerie and unnerving of all. For tickets, 302-831-2204 or DelawareRep.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Everyone knows partisanship has crippled the political process. Former Congressman Nikki Edwards has some ideas to fix it. Big ideas, but also, how about both parties speak from the same podium in Congress? These stories and a check-in on the UN. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, the fully inclusive Waldorf Kindergarten offers full and half-day programs in a socially and emotionally rich environment where children learn through play in a holistic and nurturing setting. Learning is accomplished through puppet shows, seasonal celebrations, art, music, storytelling, and an abundance of outdoor activities and play. Hosting an open house at Camp Hill Special School's Chester County campus on October 6th. Details at camphillkindergarten.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Mark Blumenthal, senior polling editor of the Huffington Post, the founding editor of pollster.com. He served as a polling analyst for the National Journal. Also with us is Alan Abramowitz. He's a professor of political science at Emory University. He has accurately predicted the popular vote winner of every presidential election since 1988. And Alan, I wanted to ask about that and the kind of criteria that you have used in order to come up with the popular vote winner.
Well, I was afraid you were going to ask me about that.
I know. I'm sorry, but it fits very nicely into our conversation. Go ahead.
Well, this is an enterprise called statistical forecasting modeling of presidential elections that a number of political scientists and some economists as well engage in. I have a model that's very simple. I take the president's approval rating in the middle of the election year at the end of June, the difference between approval and disapproval. Then I look at the growth rate of the economy, the real GDP, in the second quarter of the election year. And then I add in one other factor, which is a sort of incumbency factor, but it depends on whether it's a first-term incumbent or a later term incumbent versus or no incumbent. And what I found is you combine those three factors, and before the conventions take place, before the real final push of the campaigns begins, you can come up with a pretty accurate prediction of how the election is going to turn out. Elections are largely determined by these sort of fundamental factors, what people think about the incumbent president's performance and the condition of the economy, as well as this sort of first-term incumbency advantage. If you do that, and I've modified the incumbency advantage a little bit to take into account the growing polarization of the American electorate this year. And you put those things together, and I came up with a prediction actually back in at the end of July that Obama would win the popular vote, but it would be very close. The margin would be about one percentage point.
But, we don't elect our presidents by popular vote. It's the Electoral College. So
that's right.
So that doesn't mean he necessarily becomes or gets a second term.
Well, there is a very strong correlation between the popular vote and the electoral vote. So unless the popular vote gets extremely close, meaning probably within one percentage point, one way or the other, then the probability that the popular vote winner will also win in the Electoral College is actually very high. But when it gets extremely close, within one percentage point, then yes, there is always the chance, as we saw in the 2000 election, for the first time in 112 years, that the popular vote winner ultimately, at the end of a long and controversial court battle because of the confusion in Florida, did end up losing the electoral vote.
Well, picking up on that, Mark, and going back to you, then we'll get back to our callers. There's talk about a convention bounce or lack of a bounce, that we've got four debates coming up in the fall. Do they influence how voters might make a decision when it comes to November?
Well, historically, and when you use the term historically in reference to polling, you're talking about going back to about 1950. So over the course of the last 50 or 60 years, since 1960, since the presidential debate started in earnest, they typically don't make a lot of difference.
Really?
What most people do when they watch them is that they tend to reinforce the opinions that most have going in. There have been there's probably one, I think, well-known example of where they really changed a lot of minds, or at least that was the appearance, and that was the debate with Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, where Ford misstated the status of Poland. And it was really more the coverage that came right. in the week after the debate than the experience of the debate itself. The convention period has been over that 60-year period typically more influential. That's when there have been bigger changes, and honestly, most of them, the biggest ones, or at least the last three or four elections, have seen smaller changes than before. But it does look like this convention period boosted President Obama by a couple of percentage points, which in a close race is a lot.
Hmm. Let me get that. Looks like David from Yardley to join our conversation. And David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Great show. This is a very important topic.
Thank you.
I have two quick questions for your guests. The first one is about the robocalling. And I was wondering if your guests could talk about whether there's any indication that they get different results with robocalling surveys, frankly, because of the kind of person who doesn't hang up on the machine, mm-hmm. kind of person who answers the calls. And I was also wondering, with regard to polling results, you know, you see these polls that are done on behalf of a certain candidate or done about candidates. One of them says one candidate's 2 points ahead. The other one says they're 3 points behind. Could your guests talk a little bit about how pollers try to manipulate the poll to get certain results, and also what polling organizations are really trying to be objective versus when we hear poll results on a certain network that say a certain candidate's doing well, and we hear who did that poll, if we can say, oh, okay, that's right. not, that's like a political polling organization. That would be really helpful. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thanks.
David, thanks for the call. Alan, so who are the good pollsters, or what's a good way to at least analyze whether you're getting accurate information or not?
Well, I think we've already talked about the difference between automated polls and live interviewer polls with calls to cell phones. The main difference has to do with the fact that the automated pollsters are not able to call cell phones, and again, so that could skew the sample and affect the results, and we are seeing some differences there. As far as who's a legitimate pollster and who's not, I mean, generally, I think almost all the major polling organizations and the ones that are reported, for example, on the HuffPost pollster website are legitimate in the sense that they are trying to get accurate results because at the end of the day, if their results are skewed, if they miss the outcome, they're going to look bad. And if they look bad, then they're going to be out of business pretty soon. There have been one or two cases, I think, in recent years of polling organizations that have been called out, for actually faking their polls. At least one that I can think of a couple of years ago, or maybe it was 4 years ago, that it seemed like they just really weren't doing any polling and mm-hmm. they were just kind of making up the numbers. I think that's very rare. So I think they're pretty much all legitimate, but that doesn't necessarily mean that their results are all equally accurate.
David, thanks for the call. And Mark, if I can toss you his first question, wanting to know, a profile of a person who would talk to a computer versus a human being when being polled by on their telephone.
Well, it's a tough question to answer. The ways we would go about trying to find that out would be doing the things we've talked about already, looking at the difference in accuracy between one kind of survey and another. All surveys now are getting pretty low response rates.
Right.
So, and I'm a little more general on this, there was a really helpful research study by the Pew Research Center released earlier this year that looked at who responds to surveys. And they went and they did several used several techniques to try to figure out who didn't respond when they called with live interviewers. One of the things they found is that people who volunteer more in their communities tend to be a lot more apt to participate in surveys, and that was with live interviewers, which I know wasn't your viewers or your listeners' question. The one place, again, it gets back to this sort of trade-off. It may well be that non-voters tend to hang up more often when they get a robocall asking them election questions. And that's not necessarily a disadvantage. That it may be that when called by a human being and asked, are you likely to vote, people tend to exaggerate that likelihood. I do think there are some trade-offs in these different methods.
Yeah, go ahead, Alan.
I was just going to say that that also kind of gets at one of the differences between a lot of the academic surveys and polls that are done by media organizations or political campaigns, in that with academic surveys, we actually want to talk to non-voters because one of the things we're interested in is why people vote or don't vote and how that's changing over time. So for our purposes, it's important to actually include as many of these non-voters as possible to get actually a representative sample of the eligible voters, not just the actual voters.
Let me see what Jim from Why I'm Missing has to say. David, thanks for your call. And Jim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. Great show.
Thank you.
I was calling about how common is polling fraud, but I think you started to address that earlier. My second question is there a professional code of ethics for pollsters, and what would that include?
Can I speak to that?
You can, Mark. Yes, go ahead.
Those questions are wonderfully related. There were two instances, one that Alan's remembering, that both kind of came out of, well, one in particular came out of the American Association for Public Opinion Research, which is the predominant organization of pollsters, enforcing their ethical code around the 2008 election. And one of the things that all pollsters agree on, I mean, there are a couple of things that are very, very, that are the highest standard. One is that we never, ever compromise the confidentiality of respondents, their identities. We never reveal who participated in the survey or connect individuals with their answers publicly. But the other is disclosure. Pollsters are supposed to tell you how they did their poll. They're supposed to tell you what their response rate was and the days on which they did the poll and the questions that they asked. And in 2008, looking at some problems, particularly around the New Hampshire primary, APOR put together a committee that wrote a report, and they sent out requests to a lot of pollsters, and there was one who simply refused to provide any answers and was censured by APOR. And that censure led our friend Nate Silver to make the accusation that their numbers didn't look kosher. And some other statisticians looked at it and believed that they saw patterns in the data that indicated fraud. The pollster that was accused threatened to sue everyone and then disappeared. Went out of business, stopped doing polls, and hasn't heard from again as a pollster. He apparently still runs a PR business.
And who was that? I'm curious who was.
It was a company called Strategic Vision.
And they were doing a lot of polls.
Georgia. They were releasing a lot of polls.
Yeah, they were putting out a lot of numbers.
Right.
Alan, and then we'll get back to our callers. I'm also curious about when there are polls and this issue about likability comes up, whether a potential voter feels that comfortable with a candidate or likes that candidate. How do we understand that, or how do you understand that? What does that tell us, if anything?
Well, there is sometimes a difference between how voters evaluate a candidate in terms of their policies, the issues, the issue positions that they're taking, and what they think about the candidate as a person. We do evaluate candidates based on both of those things. We take into account both what they stand for and their record in office, but also we do take into account the certain personality traits, and I think that's actually a good thing because character counts, and it is important to know something about this person who's going to be an elected official, whether it's president, a member of Congress. Competence, compassion, their ability to relate to the problems of ordinary citizens. And indeed, I think we're seeing in this year's election and in the polling results that those characteristics are having some effect on voters' evaluations of the presidential candidates. It's one of the areas where I think Governor Romney is having some difficulty right now because a lot of voters perceive him as someone who is rather out of touch and remote and kind of doesn't relate well to ordinary Americans. So those things do make a difference, and people do form opinions about them based on what they see of the candidates.
Let me squeeze one more caller in. We have Rich from Westchester joining us on Radio Times. Rich, go ahead. You're on the air. Whoops, I think we lost him. His question, Mark, was the do not call a registry. Our pollsters, it sounds like they are allowed to call our landlines. So they...
Their pollsters are exempt from the do not call restrictions with the exception of that automated dialing to cell phones, which is a different law.
And Alan, how much does vice presidential selection, how much do you think that matters? And perhaps it depends on who the person is, but is that a big factor in terms of voter turnout and who might win or lose an election?
Right. Well, actually, from what we can tell looking at the impact of vice presidential candidates through the years, at least over the last 50 years or so, the answer seems to be not very much.
Hmm. Right.
Voters don't seem to really be weighing the vice presidential candidates very much. In 2008, Sarah Palin was one of the most high-profile vice presidential candidates in recent years. She got a lot of attention. People were very interested in her. Her acceptance speech at the Republican convention got a higher, got a larger audience than either McCain's or Obama's acceptance speech. But in the end, I don't think she had much impact on the outcome. Republicans, people who already liked John McCain liked her. People who already disliked John McCain disliked her. We're seeing the same thing this year, I think, with Paul Ryan. There's very little evidence that Paul Ryan's selection has moved the dial one way or the other.
Well, we could go on, but the clock tells me we have to end the discussion. And thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, Alan Abramowitz.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Us as well. And he's the Alvin W. Barkley Professor of Political Science at Emory University. Joined us from the studios of Emory. Mark Blumenthal, thank you very much as well.
Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. He's senior polling editor of the Huffington Post and the founding editor of pollster.com. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. You can also check us out at whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.